and your life gets it all together. And Jung makes use of dreams as a particular content to put it all together. So it's putting it all together, getting it all together. That's what Jim Burton says Holden Village is all about, getting it all together through Jesus Christ. It's the one place in the church that, according to Conrad Burgendorf, gets it all together. He says the colleges fail to do so. They got too tied up with certain academic traditions as well as certain kinds of crediting agencies that pull them out of context with Jesus Christ, in whom all things are put together. But shaped by the Word made flesh, again a symbol, putting it all together, we get it all together in Him, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So we are under this continual shaping symbol, which is Jesus Christ. And the word Christ is not a name, it's a title. The Messiah, the Anointed One, the one given to put it all together for us. So putting it all together is what a symbol means. Or getting it all together, one way or the other, or throwing it all together. Putting it all together. That's symbol. For instance, one of the great symbols that we repeat together, as we say, with the whole Christian church and shaping ourselves as a community, and we are shaped by it, is that particular symbol or creed called the Apostles' Creed. It was not written by the apostles. It was shaped up through the history of the church in its response to Scripture's witness, to Scripture's Lord, in putting it all together. And how do you put all the Scriptures together? See, and a creed is putting the whole thing together. Creation, redemption, the restoration of all things. The foretaste of the powers of the coming age, the shape of things to come, that is the church, the community of Jesus Christ, the resurrection community. And that's putting it all together, the Apostles' Creed. Creation, redemption, restoration of all things in the Holy Spirit. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Putting it all together, the fullness of God within church, we call it. Putting it all together, the fullness of God. Not Jesus only, but in Jesus to see the Father and through Jesus to receive the Spirit is putting it all together in Christ. See? That's putting it all together. Now that's what the word symbol means. That's the word sim, S-Y-M. We transliterate the Greek ypsilon in English into Y. And the Greek nun before B becomes M. Me. Symbolism. Symbolism. And bolism from the word bole, to throw together, put it all together. Symbolism. And according to Jung, in his discovery of man, it's his dream life that puts it all together. You can lie to yourself while you're awake, but when you lie in your bed, you can't lie to yourself anymore, and your dreams put it all together for you. And this is his particular contribution, that man is a totality, including his dreams. Dreams aren't something to discard, they aren't something just crazy. I had a crazy dream last night. Okay, maybe that crazy dream is just an insight into how crazy it is for you right now. But you're a total person. And he believed very strongly in the meaning of dreams, not only in capturing you, but capturing you in your total togetherness, putting it all together for Jung. And this is where he disagrees with Freud and the other analysts of man in our century who have tended to abstract man from his total environment, to take him out of his context with his total humanity, and to make him into a 20th century man. What Howard Hung calls with disdain and discuss the cult of modernity. One of our good thinkers and one of the thinkers here, Howard Hong, one of our great Kierkegaardian scholars, he calls it the cult of modernity. Truth ends with me. So I am above what shaped me. I am outside of what shaped me. I am outside of what is shaping me. I'm outside of you. I'm independent. I need no one. You see? And in that kind of a deification of himself, man becomes subject to the demonic, to the very shape of these demons, and demons can be positive. The demonic aspect can be a positive feature as well as a negative, even in Scripture. One of the men who's dealt with this very much, the man was youth director of the World Council of Churches, and he wrote a whole book on the neutral meaning of some of these terms, that they are, in Jesus Christ, they become subject to you and are working for you. The powers, the dominions, the authorities, and so on, that Paul speaks of. And that in Jesus Christ, those are no longer threatening, but subject to you. Or as Herb Lottig puts it very succinctly, even the devil has to work for the Christian. See, because all things work together for good to them that love God. So even the devil has to work for you, he puts it that way. But in other words, you are no longer under the threat of this whole shaping past
but are in the creative use of it, open to it, aware of it, and yet aware that you're only aware of a little tiny portion of it. This all our thinkers in the 20th century share. William James, one of our great American thinkers, and Mary thinks I should give you some sessions on him, and I will. He's a man you should know. He stole a lot of his stuff from a man by the name of Dilthey, D-I-L-T-H-E-Y, and we should know a little bit about him. He's gradually being translated now into English a little bit, but Dilthey stands behind even Jung and some of the others. In the great word that's also part of this whole thing, and the great word for Dilthey was fairstaying, and our English word here is a dandy one for that, fairstaying, which in German, through, under, with, to stand with and under and through, in the English too, under. And under is a good word in English. It's a lot wider than just meaning standing under something, but to understand. That's putting it all together, isn't it? That's coming into a communication, into a community. To understand is to be in not only communication with a sense of one moment, with one person, in one situation, but totally yourself and what shapes you, your past, and the future that is also part of this whole coordinate thing, though, working together and shaping us. Because we're not just shaping a future, we're being shaped by it. And this some of our fine thinkers have been able to put across, and we in the gospel very much understand this. We're never misshaped by our past, we say, but we're continually being reshaped by our future. We're living under a hope. God is our future, this sort of thing. Well, this understanding, this kind of totality of understanding, is what comes into a 20th century man. We're trying to understand 20th century man, where he's at. His own revolt against his past, his attempt to abstract it, to make it something rational and logical, we'll read a little bit about, because Jung is in an entire struggle with that, whole movement of rationalism, of abstracting, of trying to make it something logical and subject to logical analysis. You're an individual. And he refutes any attempt to subject you as an individual to his own kind of a structure interpretation of you. The interpretation of a dream of another will not help you in the interpretation of yours. Your dream is you, see? And this involves a real concentration, an individuation with each person. And it is always person to personal. This is no kind of structure, this is no kind of gimmick by which you can go around now and sort of take people apart. You can do this with Freud. You can't do it with Jung. Each person, each individual, each situation, each dream has its own kind of context and must be understood in and of itself in relationship to all the totality that you are in the whole totality of your humanity, from your most distant past on. He made famous a word here with relationship to this, and that's the word archetype. A-R-C-H-E. Archetone, the first, the beginning, the original, and type, typos, T-Y-P-O. The shaping image. What is the shaping image in your life? These archetypes may be deep things rooted way back in the unconscious past from the very beginnings of our human race. And we're part of that. 20th century man tried to refute and refuse these archetypes as having anything to do with him. And this became his tragedy, because then they devoured him. When you don't confront them, when you're not aware of them, then they will destroy you. This is Hitler and his movement of blood and soil. Blood and soil are two root words that belong to the archetypal kind of shaping images in you and me. Blood, soil, you see. And he could make it a destructive image that became demonic and tyrannized man. And yet it gave him a sense of transitory meaningfulness that he didn't have in what had happened to him when he refuted his own past and this whole area of the unconscious. This area that was not neatly given to him to divide and put down A, 1, 2, C under A, 1, 2, 3, see? And when he couldn't do this with it, he refused, he wouldn't have anything to do with it, and it destroyed him. It made him subject to itself. It's only when you're open to it and see it, and when you have this openness, that you can put it all together. Otherwise, then your dreams unfortunately become reality, and you have the superior man of the Teutonic myth. You see, taking all others under him and destroying all that stands in his way. The Jew must go, see. He is an usurper upon our soil, and he is a perverter of our blood. He can intermarry with us. He must go. He is a destructive disease in our midst. 6 million must perish, you see. That kind of demonic, destructive thing that grows out of man's refusal to face his own past. He has what Heidegger, the greatest of the contemporary German thinkers, calls in his own rootlessness, his Geworfenheit. He uses the words Geworfen, Geworfen, Geworfen. It's to throw, his thrownness. He's simply thrown. And his throne, he's just tossed about. He has no place to stand again. He has no place to root, no place to grow, no place to put it all together. And that pusto we've spoken about briefly now to people already is what we're concerned about in this whole lifestyle enrichment. The place to stand. And Mary will be bringing that up. That's where the creeds, the symbols come. They give us the place to stand. That's where scriptural's witness to scriptural's Lord becomes central. So like T.S. Eliot put it very, very beautifully and succinctly, there is no greater chasm amongst modern man than that which divides those who accept revelation and those who reject it. That's your place to stand. Outside of that place to stand, there is no place to stand. And each man is simply a Geworfenheit, a thrownness. He's a leaf thrown by the wind. And though he has individuation like each leaf, so what? He's but to be burnt. His final meaning is a poor beef-producing animal. And after 50, he shouldn't be allowed to obstruct the way of youth on the earth, because after that he'll be less and less eatable. So let's eat him earlier. The meaningfulness then of man under his symbolism, putting it all together. So what we're talking about, 20th century mentality, will be the overarching theme of these various discussions and lectures that we'll be having. And it will be for an attempt to understand, and to understand totally, the whole person. And Jung's whole concern is for wholeness, how man comes to terms with himself and his past in its totality, so he lives with it. And he has a beautiful phrase for this. A very beautiful phrase for this that I shall say it in Norwegian as well as English, so it helps Kari follow along. Hvordan man skal bo med hans skygge. How man shall live with his shadow. How does he live with his shadow? Biologically and psychologically, you and I, each one of us, are made up of both male and female, as he points out. Every man has his anima, his female image. Every woman has her animus, her male image. How does she live with that shadow? Or is it like these TV images that we have ghosts now? And we were so glad to discover when this man came up the weekend that we don't have ghosts up here on our TV. What does this mean? It means when one image is ahead of the other, isn't it? And they don't catch up, and so you have a blurring. When modern man became so rational that he refuted and would not confront the irrational in his makeup, he became tyrannized by the irrational. He didn't overwhelm it by ignoring it. He became tyrannized by it and overwhelmed by it, and it almost destroyed him under Hitler, Mussolini, and these other racisms of our time. Racism is an archetype. It's the fear of the new, the fear of the stranger, the fear of the one who is different. He has a big word for this. He calls it misonism. It just means fear of the new. We have a proverb in Norwegian that goes way back. Vaso nir av det onde. Whatever is new is of the devil. It's fear of the new. Every race has it when it confronts another race. They do things differently. They're barbarians. They don't know nothing. They don't speak English. All barbarian means, when the barbarians tried to speak Greek, that's the way it came out. Barbar, 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 barbar. See, they couldn't speak Greek, so they were called barbarian. They called us that in the Midwest, newcomers who couldn't speak the English language correctly. So we were a bunch of outsiders, Norwegians and Swedes and so on. Dumb Swede is sort of part of the English language, isn't it? And this is because we didn't speak the English language correctly. We didn't understand it. The governor of Montana was telling us when we were going to have a big youth convention in Missoula about the trouble he got as an immigrant from Sweden over here, because here he was carrying two ties on the railroad. Everybody else is carrying one. He's a big guy in the farm, and said to him,
He said, Ole, take five, Ole, take five. And he says, take five, I'm taking two already, I quit. You see? he said in his brogue, Oh, take five in America means you take off. You slop off, you take 5 minutes off. He thought it was to carry five ties instead of two, so he quit the job. Well, this is where we got the idea, sort of like we were a bunch of dumb Swedes. The fear of the role of the stranger, the bringing of the new. Now, America is a strange land in that it's brought a lot of these archetypes together from these various distinct cultures and confronted us with one another. But the one that really causes the most horror to us in America is black over against white, isn't it? There's so many of them and they're so different. They enjoy life in a different way than we do. They express themselves through their body. We find it difficult as Europeans because we have been under this whole despoiling of man through his rational understanding. And only what man understands of himself would we even admit as being subject to logical analysis, and that was what was reasonable. And the whole rest of man was tried to be dismissed. And you got bourgeois man of 19th century Europe that created a revulsion in man's spirit against which Nietzsche revolts and Karl Marx revolts and Freud revolts, and which Jung is revolting against, because Jung is revolting against the 19th century distortion and destruction of man that you see so oftentimes in the kind of apartments Europeans live in even now, covered with pictures you can't see a wall, as if Lao Tse was necessary to be read to understand that space speaks. None of us can stand it when there's no space, but they had no space in their homes and no space outside of them. And my Greek, and he's an interesting fellow to know because he's got a great knowledge of this symbolic, and he's become more and more an understandable modern painter. He's a Belgian, my Greek, M-A-I-G-R-E-T. When Elise saw one of his paintings in Europe, she said, we've got to buy more land on the North Shore. Why? Because one of his paintings has got men with briefcases and derby hats raining from heaven. You can't get away from them. It's even raining men with derbies and briefcases, Because when you get down on the continent, only Norway and Sweden and Finland have space, you see. There's no space on the continent. Even their forests are geflecht, planted by man, and they feel that way, and the trees are the same distance apart, And man's spirit can't stand that sort of a rational distortion of everything else that's in him. The internal upsurge of man is denied. Man from the start has got not only the Apollonian aspect, Apollos, the god of the sun, of clarity, of intelligence, but he has the Dionysian. Mr. Gal has done a good deal with it in our society, but we won't go into her right now. But the Apollonian versus the Dionysian, these are the two gods of the Greeks, Dionysian, who represent these two contrasting aspects in man. Man liked to think of sort of the female being the Dionysian, and man was the symbol of clarity, intelligence. But Athena also has that. And sapienta, wisdom, is part of the woman image in the anima. According to Freud, for 20th century man, it doesn't come through. He may get as far as the Virgin Mary, which he makes the third aspect or status of this anima. But the Apollonian versus the Dionysian conflict in man is a real thing. Nietzsche represents the Dionysian revolt against the Apollonian aspect of 19th century man, for example. Dionysius is the god of ecstasy, of orgy, of drunkenness, of wine, of the whole sexual urges in man and so on, that subterranean aspect that would come out and celebrate and have a great dance and a great festival in the Greek culture. Dionysian versus the Apollonian. The daytime and the nighttime aspect of man's makeup. The rational, wide-awake intelligence versus what happens in man's sleep, the Dionysian. In my Apollonian nature, I know this poor guy I was swinging by the heels the other day and throwing him across the dining room was to be pitied. In my Dionysian self, I want to throw him across a cafe and bang his head against the wall for charging me $3.75 for two desserts I shouldn't have been eating, but Mary urged me to eat, which is the last thing she does, by the way. Okay, but this is the Apollonian Dionysian. You start to analyze your dream life, and you have to use the Apollonian aspect to understand the Dionysian, but you don't deny it. See, this kind then of an understanding, these archetypes. My Greek is interesting, not least, too, from one of these other pictures, because
as you'll see as you go through Jung, we'll see it, that idea of a rock, a place to stand. Dos pusto kai teneso tengen. A rock, a place to stand, a point of reference, something from which other things now become judged and set in their proper value, their proper perspective, is necessary for any kind of order in human existence, any kind of understanding or meaning. A pusto. And Magritte has one of his pictures where you've got a huge big rock just up there in the air. There it is. You know, and you look at it and it gives you an awful feeling. It's got to be somewhere, but no, it's just up there. See, modern man has got no place to stand. His rock is just up in the air. See, it's just there, and that's one of his paintings, just presenting modern man's predicament. No pusto, no place to stand. No reference, no shaping image, which you have under the lordship of Jesus Christ. You see him as the shape of Western society. But a man who's finished an ordinary high school doesn't see this at all. I went to pieces my last year at Central High in Minneapolis. My last semester, I skipped 38 out of 38 days, and that's a long time. That's 7 weeks, almost 8 weeks I'd skipped out of a total of about 16 or so things, because I couldn't see the sense of it all. So what? So what? I asked everybody. I asked the principal. So what? So what? And nobody could give me an answer to any so what. There was no answer in the public school system. What's the sense of it? So I'm the highest boy in my class. So what? See? So you get these honors. So what? So you are the homecoming queen. So what? So you get to be captain of the football team. So what? Any person, any sense, realize high school is sort of an analogy of life, isn't it? And you get through the high school and you're suddenly, right, is that all life is? Empty is that? Is this it, you know? Capture a few prizes, huh? A little obituary in the newspaper? A few people following your cortege to the seminary, wherever they may be. Oh, he never made an enemy. So what? Well, this is, when we get it all together, we have to have a pusto. So let's just, right now, since you're all Greek scholars, we might as well get that down. Because this is what we're going to get. Some help from Jung on. We get help from wherever it comes. We're glad for it. Even though we're shaped by Scripture's witness, the Scripture's Lord, as Barth has put it so well, it's those things in Scripture we don't understand which ought to focus our attention not least. Now dismiss them. Because there are untold riches for your future, because your psyche hasn't caught up with it yet. And your psyche is still in shape. It's being formed. You can't jump outside yourself to see it, but you are in the shaping of your spirit, your human spirit. And man cannot get a perspective to his own spirit that's outside of it, you see. You're inside it. It's in your dreams where you get some hint about it, according to Jung, and those hints should be seen. Like Kierkegaard put it so beautifully, a possibility is a hint from God. Your dreams may give that. One must follow it. Not to do so, he says, is a torment in eternity. And your dreams give us some hint of where you're frustrating this whole aspect of yourself and these archetypes in our outside. And where the pusto is being missed, so you're slipping all over the place and you're not getting, it's a real easy one to get. Dos. Pusto. Kai. Kineso. And our word kinetic comes from this. Movement, kineso, tain, gain, and that's it. That happens to be the adjectival form of gain, but our word geology comes from that G-E. Give where I shall stand and I shall move the world. Dos pusto kai kineso tain gain. And the whole quest of education is this, the whole quest of culture is that, that you find a pusto, a place to stand, pusto. Dos, pu, sto, kai, kineso, tain, gain. That much we can say from the Greek, that isn't hard. Dos is to give. Dos, a donation comes from it. The word donation is a gift, isn't it? Dos. Dos, pu, sto, give where I shall stand, and I shall move the world. Dos, pu, sto, kai, kineso, tain, gain. Can you say it together? Dos, pu, sto, kai, kineso, tain gain. I'm giving you a little bit of a rest from all these names for a minute to just give you this a minute and we'll go back. It's not bad to have a little mimetic experience, a memorizing experience together. Dos pusto kai kineso tain gain. We're concerned about the pusto, where shall man stand? And he will have no place to stand if he has to fly, if he has to flee from himself. He's frightened of that which his dreams are trying to tell him. And all of us will have these. I recall in last year of college, and somewhat my second year, I had recurring dreams, the same ones. I was in a great forest, in the shadows, and planting trees where they could never hope to grow. There were already plenty of trees there, and I was planting some more. Or I was out on the prairies, 2,000 miles away from an ocean, and visiting with a Norwegian farmer who built a beautiful Viking ship. No place for it to be. I'd wake up, and I could translate for myself for ease. I was going into the ministry. There were already plenty of guys going into the ministry. Going to give back to the Norwegians what they'd already had too much of already, maybe. And why should I go and let the tribe sort of suffocate me? Nothing was going to happen. And this was my unconscious mind fighting against this decision of mine to go into the ministry. And I could interpret that. Or you take, for example, I had a dream in Norway. When I had gone to sleep, I thought I finally found a phrase that kind of pulled it all together, putting it all together. And that was respondeo ergo sum. Respondeo ergo sum. That's the Latin, respondeo, I respond, ergo, therefore, sum, I am. And to seem right back from when I was an amoeba in the ocean responding to the light, and the first response of vegetation becoming animal response, etc., you know, difference between the animal, vegetable kingdom, right up till this response to Jesus Christ when I really came into my own image of who I was to Christ. So that response made it. I felt very good about this. Went to sleep thinking, ah, got it all together. I had a horrible dream. It was a nightmare. I couldn't respond at all. I was suffocating. I couldn't speak. And I was sitting straight up in bed and screaming when I woke up. And of course, my wife wakes up when these things happen to me too. And then I started to laugh. And then I told her what had happened. And I was laughing. Why? What does the psalmist say? My reins also instruct me in the night season, he says. That's what the psalmist says. My unconscious mind tells me what it's all about when I'm asleep, the psalmist says. That's back in the scriptures, way back in the Old Testament. They knew that much. What was my unconscious mind telling me? A little baby, what makes it live? God's response to the baby. Baptism tells us that. The senile person, like Grant, my father-in-law with his beautiful mind, who finally could only count up to 20 and back to 20 again, that's all he could do. And was he living? Yes, because who responds to him? God. I remember Fritz Norris had telling us a beautiful story before all the youth used to go out on our parish visitation team. About a woman up at Wilmer. No one ever wrote her, no one visited her. She was out of communication with everyone, but she was a woman. She was a child of God. She was because God was responding to her, even when she could no longer respond to anyone and no one was responding to her, she was still real. This is our insight from Jesus Christ, you see. We exist, we are because God responds to us. So I don't exist because I respond, I exist because God responds to me. And that's what Karl Barth starts with. Why do you live? Because a word has been spoken to you. Why are you man? Because a word has been spoken to you. What word? God's word. You are because God is. And that's why you are. And this is where Barth begins. And he has a whole great, beautiful essay simply on God is. So, just coming back over to God is. And there's no way, as Jung says, in any way by your symbols to define the divine or to make it in any way actual for you, because you can't do this, because you can't do this. God is God, and you are man. No more than you can define yourself, because you're caught within yourself. You see? But you can get these hints that your dreams give you. Well, we'll go back now and just give a little bit more. Dos pusto kai kineso tingin. We're concerned about the understanding of the 20th century mentality. And as I say, the 20th century mentality has tried to assume that man is rational, and that he is a rational being as such. It forgot he's a plain animal, made him into kind of a work animal, didn't it? It made a work ethic that almost destroyed him out of his rationality, what counts as our duty. It forgot this whole other aspect of man. Finally then, his ghosts catch up with him and destroy him. You have, according to Time magazine that put it on its front cover, a symbol for understanding 20th century man is Edvard Munch's picture. He's a Norwegian artist. And he has a painting called Rupet, the Shriek. And they have simply this woman shrieking into the night from a bridge. And that's modern 20th century man. What's left of him is simply a shriek. And then he's ready for the shriek, isn't he? The psychiatrist, a candidate for the psychiatrist. In cutting himself off and from his roots and becoming simply a throneness, in Heidegger's term, geworfen, this thrownness. He has destroyed and rejected the kind of shaping past of the archetypes of these great fundamental things in his life, And so he's destroyed by them. I remember Christian Century having an article when I was at the seminary in which it said, "The Offense of a Religion of Blood to the 20th Century Man of Culture," written by a 20th Century Man of Culture. And I thought, when you reject the one sacrifice that's in Jesus Christ for man, man no longer has any place to stand. He just doesn't exist. And Jung sees this very clearly. In fact, one of the first dreams you'll interpret is of such a 20th century psychiatrist who has no church, no relationship, and so he dreams that he himself is sacrificing the mass. And the way in which he interprets this is very interesting. But where he has to become sort of the church unto himself in order to continue to exist. I'll read here from just the jacket what Jung has to say about contemporary man. This is 20th century man. He lived to be 83. In 1911, he's already a noted international figure, and he carries on into the 60s. So he's functioning as a famous international medic, doctor, and psychiatrist for over half a century. I think he's the one who's also said his famous saying that he never knew anyone that came to him who was a practicing believer. I mean, someone who was really involved, because they were open to their shaping images and demons and so they were not tormented and overwhelmed by them. But he says, contemporary man is blind to the fact that with all his rationality and efficiency, he is possessed by powers that are beyond his control. This whole nature of the demonic. Remember my class at the seminary becoming furious as we developed this in Pauline theology. They couldn't see this out of our colleges. The colleges had destroyed this world. And so it's consequence. They'd lost their poetry of their existence as well as the dynamics of it. And they were really freaks. They really were. They were simply cast-offs from the whole concept of what is the shaping powers in our civilization. Because unless we see this demonic aspect of the shaping tradition, we haven't seen it. But seen it in also in its neutrality, not only its negativity, and the way in which it can be used positive. Contemporary man is blind to the fact that with all his rationality and efficiency, he is possessed by powers that are beyond his control. Notice, beyond his control. This is what he hates. And refuses to be subject in any way, so he rejects them. He says they aren't there. They can't be real. It belongs to the medieval myth, and he casts them out and then falls subject by the billions to our crazy kinds of astrologers and occult worship and so on. It's done, the man who edits this, it relates it. He says his own prejudice. He has nothing to do with the occult. And it bugs him when some people take hold of Jung and use it to try to once more enforce the occult. But the occult is there under these powers and becomes then a negative in their control of man. His gods and demons have not disappeared at all. They've merely got new names. They keep him on the run. They keep him on the run. Notice those. These are all important phrases. To be kept on the run. To not be subject. What makes Sammy run? It's the subject of a famous novel some years back. They keep him on the run. The bitch god of success. That destroys him, and D.H. Lawrence, who once more tried to emphasize these ectonic forces, these forces from the earth that shape man, his sex, his lust, his passions, that the 20th century man was trying to live without, and became something that was a head operating without a body, like in one of the science fiction stories of H.G. Wells, and where man is, then the heads have learned how to take hold of younger bodies and keep living off of them, but they're just heads that have been cut off from bodies. His gods and demons have not disappeared at all. They've merely got new names. They keep him on the run with restlessness. Restlessness. Thou will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. Restlessness. Vague apprehension. Psychological complications. An insatiable need for pills, alcohol, tobacco, food, and above all, an impressive array of neuroses. And finally, you've got that haunting voice of Hitler with its kind of demonic death tones enlisting a whole nation in self-destruction. Because finally he sees it to be self-destruction, so he's going to take them all down with him. And we have our atomic scientists with all their Apollonian rationality serving their deep Dionysian needs of self-destruction. They do not dare commit individual suicide, but have the whole race do it together. Great. And we're all through with it. We've written amen. We have power over God, and we've destroyed his universe and man with it. This is part of this whole 20th century man and his mentality. So it's something we've got to grapple with and come to see, so that we're not haunted, but we are helped and assisted in a new creativity by being open to this totality of our being. And that's what we're concerned about in this understanding, this first stand that comes out of, as I mentioned, Delphi and James, two people. As we see the shaping symbols and are willingly shaped by them because they give us our humanness. They give us our community, our interliving and interplay with each other is what a creed gives. Symbol, to put it all together, as we've had up here now. And Tillich, who's one of the fine minds of our century in trying to put psychology and the creeds together, and I have accused him personally, and believe this is true, that he psychologizes the faith, and this is his error. But at least he was not afraid of being confronted by all this totality of 20th century knowledge from this area. But he sees still the fundamental need of what he calls a Bindung. That's the German word for B-U-N-D-U-N-G, and the two dots over the U. Bindung. You know what that is in English. You can find it, can't you? From it, same word, practically. A binding, that which binds together. And your creeds say what? Our Lutheran creeds begin almost every paragraph with the same phrase. They don't say, I believe, teach, and confess. They don't say, Luther believes, teaches, and confess. They say, together with the whole Catholic Church, we believe, teach, and confess. You see? We accept the shaping tradition and identify with it. We contend and reject nothing which is Catholic, holy, that accepted at all times and all places by the whole Church of Jesus Christ. You see? This is our Bindung, that which puts us together and gives us a place to stand. And therefore, the creeds give us the first moments of our terms, the kind of understanding, so the words we use are that which are accepted by all. Otherwise, we end, as this village in the first years of existence over and over would end, in what is called a solipsism. That's the opposite of a Bindung. That's the self-destruct of a person who creates his own truth, who does his own thing, who has his own meaning, who is no longer than in any kind of a connection, a Bindung, a togetherness with the whole totality of his own person and of the whole shaping humanity. He has copped out and he says, stop the planet, I want to get off, which he can't do. But that's what he's saying by that very kind of a statement. We call that solipsism. That's where man is lost in his dream world and where I took Watergate through in that little talk I gave over the watermelon review here. And where he finally ends up and he doesn't know whether I am the one dreaming or the one dreaming is me, the doctor and the three sisters, see? And that's why he could do nothing about stopping a duel. He could have stopped it. What's one baron more or less? See? What he says before the baron's killed. Is it real or am I real? You see? And that's finally what happens to that kind of a cop. And what does he have to do? In order to support that kind of thinking, finally he has to do it through what? Well, what became finally one of the great threats still? All kind of communication of any kind in our society. Drugs, didn't it? And when you're on it, then you're really communicating and you'd listen. We had him on it up here and you'd listen to him. And what were they saying? Right on, man, right on. And the other guy was doing what? Grunting like a pig. You know, there was no communication at all. You see, it was a complete destruction of everything human. In the interest of what? Some kind of a dream. Oh, boy, I was on a trip, you see. What kind of a trip? One that could be, in any sense, shared, communicated, related to, identified with? See, the great word for Delphi out of that first stand became then your response. Every man shapes his own history and is a shaper of history, according to Delphi, James, and the whole bunch, right down to Buckminster Fuller. And Buckminster Fuller used that delightful little illustration in the February Playboy last year, or 2 years ago, when last year you were at Ames, you bought it for me. And he had that little thing on the rudder. He says, you like to think that your life is meaningless. You're just looking at a ship going past. But you're that little thing on the rudder that determines the rudder. That's what I am, he says, and I know it. Therefore, I can sin. I know it. Very few people can sin, he says. They don't even know that. They don't have enough knowledge to sin. But when you know that, then you are not just a victim, like the drug addict was always the victim. That's why he copped out. He got that set of parents. He got this bum steer being born in this century. He got the cruddy deal of having to be an American with the rest, half the rest of the world eagerly trying to get in here one way or another if they could, but he wants out. He is a complete distortion of self-pity, isn't he? He's a shriek of self-pity. And the way out is this dream world, his own self-destructive. But when we are in the bindung, out of this openness to the total past, we have a place to stand, we have a kind of leverage, and we're on. We're on our way. I'm going to read here a little bit from Jung because it's fun. Then we can face up with this kind of totalness, this totalness of ourself. Jung's thinking has colored the world of modern psychology. I'm reading from the preface now. It's a good one. Jung's thinking has colored the world of modern psychology more than many of those with casual knowledge realize. The familiar terms, for instance, as extrovert, introvert, and archetype are all Jungian concepts borrowed and sometimes misused by others. But his overwhelming contribution to psychological understanding is his concept of the unconscious, not the subconscious of Freud, merely a sort of glory hole of repressed desires, but a world that is just as much a vital and real part of the life of an individual as the conscious, cogitating world of the ego, and infinitely wider and richer. In other words, restoring this Dionysian, this totality of the inward self and the shaping past and the archetypal images and the whole racial experience to this moment in time of which I am conscious. And he's not alone in this by any means. Very rational thinkers like Whitehead deal with this, or Bergson, and we'll take up both of them as you get acquainted with these people a little bit, because their names you need to know to understand the 20th century, what man is trying to understand in this conflict about himself. But they're very much in the philosophical forefront. Logical analysis tries to get away from it and only makes itself into a kind of a freakish kind of a dead end. One of the leaders in that particular movement, living next door to a relative of mine, we'll use later on for an example here, but the man most famous of the name is University of Minnesota. But they simply don't understand themselves totally, and so they're cut off and dried up, branches to be gathered into the fire and burned. But this world that is just as much a vital and real part of the life of an individual as the conscious, cogitating world of the ego, infinitely wide and richer. The language and the people of the unconscious are symbols, and the means of communications, dreams. Now, not only dreams, as Freud, Jung corrects this immediately at once, just so that you won't be caught in that. He sees it, conversations, art objects, so on. I think conversation is extreme for him. He sees this, certainly movies, Wild Strawberries, for instance, or almost anything that that Swede put out, give you this understanding of yourself. You can see, let's see. He says here, for instance, he says one could begin from Cyrillic letters, from meditations upon a crystal ball, a prayer wheel, or modern painting, or even from casual conversation about some quite trivial event. The dream was no more, no less useful in this respect than any other possible starting point. Nevertheless, dreams have a particular significance, even though they often arise from an emotional upset in which the habitual complexes are also involved. The habitual complexes are the tender spots of the psyche, which react most quickly to an external stimulus or disturbance. And so dreams are part of those totality, but they are not, you're not limited just to that. A movie like we've just seen, The Three Sisters, has certain moments in it that certainly bring up for you aspects of the totality in your unconscious. That Moscow, Moscow, Moscow repetitive motif, for instance, can be for some young girl, Hollywood, 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 or some young man, Washington, 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 can't it? Mary?
Not anymore.
I'm sorry.
Not Hollywood, not anymore.
I could see her shaking her hands. No,
Hollywood.
No, but what then?
Hollywood, isn't the aim of all young girls.
No, 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 but I said some young girl, or some young man, you know. And not, as we know, when we're in the kingdom, that wherever there are people, that's the place, you see. They never found it. As Kay and I were discussing in the movie afterwards, there wasn't a conversation in the movie. Everybody moved away from each other. Nobody moved toward each other. Nobody stood under one another. There was, at the end, a feeling of the three sisters with their arms around each other and the doctor with his longing back to them. But a real communication, no. Empathy is the word I wanted to
confused a while back, which becomes the Greek word of this sort of understanding for yourself, and empathy for yourself, as well as for one another. Not sympathy,
standing outside to relate, but in, with, and under and through. Empathy. The ability to feel with and suffer with that totality of the situation that confronts us, in ourselves or in another. Empathy. That is what we're about. And the dream helps us to sort of an empathy with each other. There are certain events of which we have not consciously taken note. They remain, so to speak, below the threshold of consciousness. They have happened, but they have been absorbed subliminally without our conscious knowledge. We can become aware of such happenings only in a moment of intuition or by a process of profound thought that leads to a later realization that they must have happened. And though we may have originally ignored their emotional and vital importance, it later wells up from the unconscious as a sort of afterthought. It may appear, for instance, in the form of a dream. As a general rule, the unconscious aspect of any event is revealed to us in dreams, for it appears not as a rational thought, but as a symbolic image, an image which puts it all together. As a matter of history, it was a study of dreams that first enabled psychologists to investigate the unconscious aspect of conscious psychic events. I'm reading now entirely from Jung himself, just on this, before we go back again. It is on such evidence that psychologists assume the existence of an unconscious psyche, though many scientists and philosophers deny its existence. They argue naively that such an assumption implies the existence of two subjects, or to put it in a common phrase, two personalities within the same individual. But this is exactly what it does imply, quite correctly. And two totalities, not just above and below. Sarx pneuma again, in the New Testament kind of two personalities, totalities. Sarx, man organized in opposition to God, pneuma, man organized under obedience to God. And this totality doesn't mean upper against the lower. But that is exactly what it does imply. What that upper and lower does is give just that kind of food over to these logical analysts, these rationalists, who would then subdue the under by the upper, and you are no longer a total being, and you exist from your neck up, and you're spiritual, spelled spirituelle, and definitely second story, and unfortunately a little crazy. In fact, you're lucky if you don't end up in a nut house. But that is exactly what it does imply, quite correctly. And it is one of the curses of modern man that many people suffer from this divided personality. It is by no means a pathological symptom. It is a normal fact that can be observed at any time and everywhere. It is not merely the neurotic whose right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. This predicament is a symptom of a general unconsciousness that is the undeniable common inheritance of all mankind. Man has developed consciousness slowly and laboriously in a process that took untold ages to reach the civilized state, which is arbitrarily dated from the invention of script in about 4000 BC. And this evolution is far from complete, for large areas of the human mind are still shrouded in darkness. What we call a psyche is by no means identical with our consciousness and its contents. And this is true for every modern thinker sees this much of it, definitely. It's exciting the way they will deal with it in different ways, as you'll get a chance through the next years to discover along in college, and not just this year. The psyche is not identical with our consciousness and its content. It's much more vast and deep. This whole meaning of what it means to be spirit or soul or human, using any one of those as coordinates, equals. Whoever denies the existence of the unconscious is in fact assuming that our present knowledge of the psyche is total. And this belief is clearly just as false as the assumption that we know all there is to be known about the natural universe. This is what I said Howard Hong mocks as the cult of modernity. We finally arrived. Too bad how stupid men have been in other generations, other centuries. We have the truth. And maybe the truth will die with us. But we have it now, see. Our psyche is part of nature, and its enigma is as limitless. Thus we cannot define either the psyche or nature. That is an understanding of man made in the image of God, that shaping Western society, that he is here saying in this way, you are infinite, just as there is no end to the little, nor no end to the large. The deeper we go, the more fathomless it becomes, and the higher we go, isn't it? It's the same for you. You are of the same kind of nature, he is saying here. Limitless. This you are. You cannot be put into neat categories and then made into something.
Europe tried to do this by your calling, your engineer so-and-so, Bispina even, wife of a bishop so-and-so, and so on. And it's ridiculous. You cannot be made equal to your task. And you certainly cannot be made equal to saying, I'm just a pastor. I'm just a housewife. I'm just a teacher. There's no justice here. There is this tremendous height and depth that's limitless that you heard in this week's prayer, isn't it? That's the prayer, Paul, for you to see. It's the height, the breadth, the length, and the depth, and to know the love of God which is beyond all comprehension, all limits, for you, that Christ may dwell in your hearts by faith, that you may know with all the totality of the church what this wonder and mystery is, you see, of your humanity, of your image, and this he's discussing. Your psyche is this. We can merely state what we believe them to be and describe as best how they function, these aspects of our nature. Quite apart, therefore, from the evidence that medical research has accumulated, there are strong grounds of logic for rejecting statements like, there's no unconscious. Those who say such things express an age-old misonism, a fear of the new and the unknown. And I'll put this up. It's the fear of the new. Miso is hate. That's the hate. For instance, misogynic means somebody who hates women. Misanthropist is somebody who hates man. Miso is hate. And neo is the new. The hatred of the new. Basa or nia of the own. Misoneus is a word he's used now, and he will be using. Now we learned that other new word today, the hatred of the new. But if you can remember the Norwegian proverb, that's better. Basa or nia of the own. Whatever is news of the devil. That's the way people think. The fear of the new. And this your conscious life will always have, and your unconscious life then will reassert all these riches that you are refusing to accept and take in. I think the best movie for seeing this that I've ever seen is Wild Strawberries. How many of you have seen Wild Strawberries, Bergson's movie? Do you remember the scientist in there? He had always been scientific. In the movie, he even sees his wife commit adultery, but he forgives her. Passionate, detached, depersonalized. He doesn't even get mad at that. He picks up these three young hitchhikers. A wise dad has sent two guys in love with his daughter off hitchhiking down to Italy. He picks them up on the way as he's going down. And you have this movie within the movie and the interplay of real life, real passion, real argument. Arguing, you know, passionately about God, about life and so on. And he's been depersonalized, dispassionate. And the movie begins simply with clocks going and coffins coming and then sort of just simply the very kind of destruction of the meaning of the infinite in making man into a kind of a clock or coffin is the way he starts off. And there's nothing real there. It's the scientific method that has destroyed man. And what we have as a reassertion, really, of the poetry of man here, under a great philosophical tradition, even rooting in Kant, this is one place where Kant has his greatness. Man in his own personalness and in his own spontaneity is something that's basic and with which Kant begins. And he has a phrase for it that you should know because you run into it, the Dingon sect. The thing in itself is forever closed to you. You do not know your own psyche and you can never really know each other. Dan put this so beautifully the night of our last talk, I thought I'd be quoting him on it. He says, it seems the more I get to know a person, the less I know him. See? That's beautiful, isn't it? Or the 10th law of Leo is just like this. There is no problem so complex that upon thorough examination, it does not become more complex. You see? And this preserves the mystery and the wonder. Unfortunately, you don't have to worry about it being lost. And like Leo closed his dedication of the new animal biology lab down at the University of Chicago 3 Christmases ago now, against this coming Christmas, but in a very terrific talk that some of the professors talked about afterwards, because he was speaking to his own peers. And then he finally gets to the end, and he was taking his takeoff. It's called the Anton Carlson Memorial Lab, and Anton Carlson was an Augustana Synod pastor who left the ministry and became a scientist and was an atheist, finally. And his famous phrase was, "What is the evidence, gentlemen? What is the evidence?" So Leo took that for the theme of his talk in his own Leo kind of a way. You can imagine what he'd do with it. And he gets to the end, he says, the evidence. And he says to his own fellow scientists there and the whole faculty there at Chicago. And he says, the evidence, gentlemen, is in a person. For the truth is a person. And you can't get them into your microscope, on your microscope, nor on your scale. In fact, the only way you can get to them is the same way a boy who hasn't finished eighth grade does, and that's on your knees. And that's the offense of the truth, gentlemen, but that's the truth. That's the way he closes it. That's the evidence. Well, this is, in a real sense, what you can get support for from Jung. And that doesn't try to make Jung into a Christian. Jung is 20th century man in revolt against the Christian tradition itself, and that's what gives him so much tenderness and insight to other people in revolt. He's the son of a Calvinist pastor, and if I had been, chances are I would have worked out like Jung too. Unfortunately, Calvin did get man always, he always deals with man fully dressed and with his shoes on. Luther, fortunately, with his enjoyment of his beer and his flute and his sense of music and his Dionysian nature, along with Apollonian, which it wasn't there with this sort of killing it off in Calvin, Luther always allows the earthy to assert itself. This is where he would not desert the bread and the wine, you know, in the Lord's Supper. And why we refuse to go over with Calvin and abstract Jesus from the bread and the wine, which was an intellectualism, an Apollonian. It makes logic, it's reasonable. Jesus is already in the midst of the disciples and says, this is my body, obviously means it represents, he's there. This is Calvin on the same subject. And Luther on the same point, he says, it is written, this is my body, and Jesus is present in his word, and he is there present in that bread and in that wine giving himself to, for he is everywhere present. And of course, the communists have a great deal of fun making fun of us Lutherans at this point, but this is where the sanctity of the whole earth comes in and the openness to all the earthiness. And why Luther can have his kind of hearty chuckle continuously and say, while we sit here and guzzle our beer, God makes his kingdom come. And that's what preserves you from the kind of revolt that Jung had, frankly. But some of you get into pietistic kinds of homes where if it's enjoyable, it's wrong, and there must be sin somewhere here. We've got to just find it, that's all, because you're enjoying yourself. Then you're going to have this kind of a rejection. But it does not need to be. But you will still find yourself in your dreams, according to him. And this is where we get with it. Now I wanted to close on this thought. That here we're in, and whenever we are involved in this idea of symbolism, place to stand, friendship is so important. The need of give and take, the need of a roommate, of being mated to somebody for whom there's room for understanding. Need of conversation, so you're not left digging at yourself with it. And that's what I worry about, for instance, in the tutorial in psychology. You start to dig at yourselves with it, and you're going to end up sick, of course. And this is not why Jung has written this book. Like the Norsky say. On the contrary, he wants you to have this kind of understanding of what time, so you're simply open to the mystery and individuation of yourself. So you make room for yourself. And because you aren't like your mother, you don't take yourself through and say, okay, there's no place for me. Because you aren't like your mother. Or you aren't like your grandmother or somebody else. So that you make room for yourself and the whole mystery and wonder and variety and richness of who you are. Because it's terrible to fear yourself, to be in conflict. And as this introduction, I return to it, concludes here, and then I'll give one little note on it again. It's this openness that prayer and the Word of God permit for us in the place to stand that allow us to deal with this and not be tormented by it, but to be in the healing of it, because there's healing here. And so here we have the ability to establish communication with the unconscious is a part of the whole man. That's where this whole aspect of the shadow and living with the shadow comes in. The ability to establish communication with the unconscious is part of the whole man. And Jungians teach themselves, I can think of no better term, to be receptive to dreams, to see that as part of your totality. What you are at night is as much you as what you are by day. When therefore Jung himself was faced with a critical decision whether or not to write this book, he was able to draw on the resources of both his conscious and unconscious in making up his mind. He had a dream. He refused to do it. He's already 83. He never was for popularizing for fear of what would happen. The people would start becoming doctors to themselves, and everybody becomes an amateur psychologist and so on. But he did this because he had this dream that he was talking to a mass audience, and the mass audience understood him. And when he had that dream, then he had to change his mindset. He'd do it. The last thing he did in life is finished it 10 days before he died. So it's sort of summing it all up, bringing it together. And that's why it's a great book, because it gives you a key to a tremendous movement in our time. And all through this book, you'll find the dream treated as a direct, personal, and meaningful communication to the dreamer. A communication uses the symbols common to all mankind, that uses them on every occasion in an entirely individual way that can be interpreted only by an entirely individual key. In fact, I'm having a little trouble with my left leg and pants, convenient, and being reelected to Holden Village and thinking of another 7 years of fundraising and people streaming through like they did this summer, or I don't get to know half of them, and so on. I have this feeling I can't go on anymore, so my leg starts to hurt. All right, if I bring this into my conscious mind related like that, the leg doesn't hurt quite so much either, and that helps a little bit. You know, this sort of thing is here in the totality of the situation. So the individual key to it. But those who reject this are in the lie. Those who think that life can be made formal, that they can bind themselves for communication by laws of conscious and formal life, with the infallible but often meaningless logic of the algebraic equation, they argue from assumed premises to incontestably deduced conclusions, and then they think thereby they've gotten at truth at life. That is the lie. This is what I brought up to the teacher of Johann at Williams when I said, were you able to teach Johann anything? And he said, no. Now, he has a bad disease right now because he was caught up, I think, in that kind of a lie of an intellectualism. And a logic analysis is giving you a key to an adequate understanding of yourself or each other. It won't. Guadino here, a fine spirit, honest device, said, then you can't teach the black either. You can't teach Johann. He said, no. In other words, I said, you're restricted to teaching a New England kind of third generation intellectuality. He says, yes. And most of those people around Williams had Roman numerals 3 and 4 after name. Dull lovers, unable to celebrate, ignorant of ecstasy, Apollonian kind of withered branches, you see. By rationality that destroys itself. G.K. Chesterton is fun to read here. He's one of the fun guys to read here because he uses it. The logic which destroys logic is illogical. And when life is made into self-destruct, it has to be illogical. And this is where the word made flesh once more becomes the truth to follow, because he allows his whole openness to the totality of yourself. So you are not destroyed in hang-ups. And a hang-up is literally a suicide of the spirit, isn't it? Hang-up. You're hung up. You can't love. You are literally hung up then, aren't you? And you aren't open. And you are self-destroying. And those who exist, as Jung says, in this rational, logical analysis approach to life, then are finally hung up and are unable to relate to their totality. And so they're no longer free to love. And they are finally dried up specimens of humanity. And you have that pathetic old doctor going down for his honorary degree at 80, and those 3 kids that are alive in the car, and he's like a corpse driving. He's never lived because his whole theme has been detachment, objectivity, scientific analysis. And it's not adequate for life. Life had its revenge by destroying him as a person, was the theme of the movie. And so, as he says, this method that is used by Jung and others is itself symbolic and often devious. It doesn't come out, or you can neatly put it down in categories and paragraphs. It's individuating, and it comes down to each one of you. And the images and symbols then become those which you yourself must interpret for yourself. But it does, he says, suddenly take hold of you as it goes on. It's like a great painting does. It's like a great story does. A narration. And the symbols within the painting or the narration lay hold of you and suddenly give you an understanding. That's what this is in terms of a method, a psychological method, that is a Jungian method. Suddenly the reader, who has never been aware of a single conclusive moment of proof, finds that he's unknowingly embraced and taken into himself some wider truth. It's a kind of spiraling, he says. It's like a tree. It's like a bird circling a tree. It's just leaves and branches. I was thinking last night that some people never can see this aspect of life because they can't see the tree for the bushes, much less the forest for the trees, we say. But they don't even see it for the bush. They're just caught. They're way down there, you know, looking at, analyzing the thing, taking it apart. And like Bergson says in his beautiful introduction to metaphysics, they always have a discipleship complex, so the truth is always hidden from them, because they can't understand a sponge until it's been taken apart and put under a microscope, and they've never dared dive into the sea to find a live one for themselves. That's from Bergson's introduction to metaphysics. Beautiful. You and the lifestyle enrichment are each one of you permitted to be divers in the sea to find your own sponge, you see, and not take apart somebody else and put under the microscope. But in the average college education, the American system, and this is true, Williams is our greatest undergraduate college. It's trained the most Rhodes Scholars. It's got a tremendous library. It has one teacher for every 9 students. You can't go any place that's more expensive in the world to get an education. And yet it can only educate a mind that's already dead. It's never come alive to its totality. It can abstract, analyze, and give you an outline. No wonder that out of that we've got 3 in the attic, and The Graduate, those are all out of Williams College, those particular books from which the movies have been made. Guys that just simply become unable to relate to their own maturity. They haven't learned to live with their shadow. There's no community. It's like Yuan used to meet with the president the last year, and he said the only solution for Williams is move the thing out to Holden Village for a while so they can discover what a community is. Because he says, none of you have known a community in your own family. You're supposed to only re-christenate, re-represent the grandfather whose name you still bear with the Roman numeral 3, see, or 4. And like Arnie Flotten used to say, nothing can kill a human spirit faster than have to carry more than one generation. It's enough you carry yourself. You can't relive your father. And this is what this allows for, this kind of openness, this sense of aliveness, and his object is always then to help men and women to know themselves so that by self-knowledge and thoughtful self-use they could lead full, rich, and happy lives. And his last final act is to give them this kind of an insight for you. He says that the chapter entitled The Process of Individuation by Dr. von Franz, it will be the sum of the whole thing, when you'll see the conscious and the unconscious within an individual, in the process by which these two come to know, respect, and accommodate one another. Because in no way do we put down the need of logical analysis and rational process. This is not an anti-intellectualism, but only we do not allow this to give us a hang-up over against the totality of what it means to be alive, for what you are as a human being joined to the human race. Finding your own identity through the Word made flesh, who allows you to be in the world but not of it, not something apart from it in a little ghetto, but in a wonderful sense, the new humanity, the new creation of God. Well, I will close there, and we will read directly from the text as we go on. I did sum up the first part of it, and you'll get a chance to get into his analysis of his term and so on. It's a fascinating edition. The artwork is tremendous in it. It's really great. I was just going to show you one picture here by Chagall, for instance. It comes very early. Here we are. Chagall has become very popular today, and here's Chagall's painting on Time is a River Without Banks. Now, Chagall would take a good person to sort of sum up this whole process. Really, you couldn't pick a better one. What did he ask that they call the museum that they just built for him in France? Kind of interesting. We had it on the bulletin board from the summer. It was just dedicated this summer for all his works. It's called Biblical Message. Biblical Message. And Chagall opened this up. For instance, one night I had to write to Oscar Anderson, who's now president of Augsburg College down in Minneapolis, just after he was re-elected there. And I had a dream one night in which he was the one having the baby. And that famous painting of Chagall's, where they're walking on the ceiling, and the only person that's sour is the mother, who is around taking care again of the kids that are already there, but everybody else is celebrating. They're walking over the walls and all over that. It's a great thing about just what birth means. Well, here's Chagall's painting on "Time is a River Without Banks." and letting the whole free flow of your imagination come, which dares to happen as Chagall sees under the biblical message. And it's interesting, he starts out with his first images are from the gospel, and that we have those symbolic animals for each gospel, the eagle and the ox and the lion, you know, that represent each one a gospel. And that you that root back into the deep unconscious of man, even in that kind of symbolic representation of the gospel. And the four gospels, and what four mean in terms of completion and totality means a great deal for Jung and his whole thinking here. He says your anima has four parts, for instance. The man, every male has these, the female part of the chromosome. Every chromosome is half father, half mother. And every man is both male, female, just as every woman is both male, female. And he calls that female aspect in man the anima, the feminine form from the Latin, and that same aspect in the woman, the animus, the masculine form. And he says that the original, the first form of it is simply the physical, the sexual, the sensual, that kind of woman. And then you have the introduction, woman is eros, of the flight of imagination, of poetry and fantasy, so on. Then you have Mary, the mother of our Lord, is the third phase of that, who is the religious, the devotion, the dedication. And then finally, Sapienta, wisdom, that captures this whole thing and brings together in wisdom, the word, and the wisdom of the word, those four aspects to man. And he says, 20th century man has been unable to realize the fourth. Wisdom has been closed off from him. When he's within the tradition of his church, and that's why he said he didn't have any practicing Catholics or Protestants who really practice faith come in him, they have found the freedom, at least of the third. But he's fortunate if he can escape the first into the second and have some life of eros and not just simply of the sensuality and discover the life of imagination and of creativity and that sort. Those are the four aspects for man. The same thing happens for woman on her side, on the animus, the four stages. Well, enough of that. We'll come into all that later. But this is a beginning. Now, lots of stuff goes over your head in a first lecture like this, and this is my first chance to be with you, so you have to learn my terms, the way I speak also. But I hope you interrupt and ask me. Now, the fact that Kari is here makes me slow down a little bit. She's the one that asked for Jung and why I decided to start this with Jung. I could have started it several other places, but Jung's a good place to start. And we have this very excellent volume on man and his symbols by Jung that you get a chance to look at and see.
Carol, can you read that someplace
where you can look at it? Yeah, I'll put it up in the dining hall where you can take a look at it and see it. I'll have to reread it and go through it myself as I lecture, but you can see it's a very fine work of art, really. But all that is man then comes in under this understanding of man and study of man. This is the fundamental study of man that Jung is concerned about. So it's a good place to begin. We'll have something later from William James on this. I think I'll take his two-volume Psychology and bring it. It reads like a novel. Henry James, William James are brothers. And it said of Henry James, he wrote novels like Psychology, and of William James, he wrote Psychology like a novel. It is a tremendous style. And he's the one whom we know as the author of pragmatism. Actually, he's the popularizer of pragmatism. Another man is its original author, but they shifted the emphasis a little bit in it. And the way James puts it is not as true as the one who was originator on that particular term. But we won't go into that later. But they're interesting kinds of men. I could have used James today just in this idea of understanding. One of his original images that he has in Psychology is that here's the conversation that occurs in terms of language as such between two people. And here they are communicating. Here are the two people. There's the language level of communication. But the actual communication that's taking place between the two is vastly greater and deeper than simply the verbalization. And as he says, the mystery remains continuously for us in all our effort of what understanding is. That essential mystery remains. What does it mean to understand? What does it mean, he says, to define, to comprehend, and so on? And the fact that we continually kid ourselves into thinking we've gotten hold of something because we can describe it in its external kind of form, but it actually evades us in the understanding. Now, I've discovered, for instance, this summer again, the same sort of aversion to this right here at the village on the part of intelligent people. Once the Uncle God went out here furious, because they had the day before on the eye opener, Rich Kamer and Paul Heen and Judy Heen and someone else with them had cooperated in a wonderful deal of how man is knit together with creation and part of creation, and that he is not simply overt in terms of cause-effect, but that he's part of this total deal. And we cannot say by cause-effect that in any way we've explained creation, because something in creation happens in terms of this to this doesn't mean one thing over against understanding the nature of a rock, or of event, or of an atom, or of energy, and so on. That we're all part of this continual deal. And Romans 8 was used beautifully in this, you know, that we're all part of this creation, agonizing, groaning together for the redemption of the sons of men. Boy, there was a revolt against this, a complete thing. Man's over it. He's the king. He's the one who does it. He has been given to exploit it, etc. See? Whereas biblically, this just is not true. And to understand it, Genesis in that way is out of context with everything that the Old Testament said. Man's a part of his environment. He's given to the earth. The Jew belongs to Judea. And even as God, in a rude and crude sense, belongs there. So that he's tempted consistently, if he moves outside that geographical confines, to adopt the God of that particular area to which he goes, rather than to remain faithful to his Jehovah, as in Egypt, for example. This real thing of belongingness to the earth, that he belongs to the earth, and he belongs to creation, in this depth sense of understanding of man and his relationship. Well, this all belongs in this context, our totality.